Thank you. Welcome, everyone, to the funeral of Stephen Thompson. Can I just remind you to switch your mobile phones off, because I forgot. And no photos, please. Some people are going to have spare seats in their cars or taxis, and some people are going to want a lift back to the reception. So in order to bring you together, I've asked my nephew Dylan to be the kind of central point. So here's Dylan. So if after the ceremony you come to him, if you've got a spare seat or if you want a seat, and I'm hoping you're all going to come back to Lauderdale House to have some refreshments and to talk about Stephen. Okay. So I think that's all now. We're going to sing. And we're going to sing the hymn Jerusalem. We're going to be accompanied by the Huddersfield Choral Society. But I hope you'll all make a good noise. Okay? I just hope he's... Steve's dad, Phil, will now give a formal tribute to Steve, and the full text, if you'd like to read it, will be available after the ceremony, okay? So Phil will be handing it out if you want to read it.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Many of you will be familiar with the poem by Dylan Thomas, which begins and ends with this famous refrain. Thomas was an alcoholic who did much to romanticize the condition. He died at the age of 39. Steve was just 33. He did not go gently, but his rage was not against the dying of the light. It was against the fact that his demands on life so far exceeded what its circumstances afforded him. It was a rage sometimes directed against those who tried to point out this painful fact, but it was an anger always tempered by an acknowledgement that they cared for him. His death was not an accident, neither was it planned, nor in any active sense anticipated. In principle, it was preventable. In practice, it was not. The word tragic is much overused today and applied to almost any unhappy circumstance. But for the ancient Greeks, whose word it was, it meant something very particular. It referred to that drama in human affairs which arises when a character's life and actions are caught up in compelling circumstances, driven by forces they cannot control, but which they think they can. The Greeks called this overestimation of human capacity hubris, and the consequences were always disastrous, completely unintended, and totally unavoidable. In this special sense, Steve's death was a tragedy. It's tempting then to say that his death, and indeed his whole life, was a misadventure, but in fact it was the opposite. He refused to use the dire circumstances of his early life as a justification for what he later did with it. For someone who at the age of 6 months was given up by his mother, who was too depressed to look after him, and disowned by his father, and who then spent most of his early childhood in children's homes and foster care, he was singularly lacking in self-pity. Instead, he threw himself into adventure after adventure with an enthusiasm less bold spirits might think reckless. His life was the embodiment of Samuel Beckett's adage, ever tried, ever failed, no matter, try again, fail better. When he came to Jean and me at 8, he was a very angry young man. There was to be no honeymoon period in this adoption, and over the next few years he tested the limits of our patience, our endurance, and our love. But however difficult he was, there were always redeeming moments, bouts of good humour and fun. Stee knew how to win and break hearts, and as he grew into a tall, dark, and handsome teenager, he had no shortage of admirers. Then he met Natalie and became a father at 18. Although they split up after their second child was born, he was determined, with Natalie's backing, to ensure that as Ricky and Casey grew up, they had the love and support he had so sorely lacked. Steve encouraged the boys in their interests, took them camping, played football with them, took them to movies, watched them at sport, did all the usual father and son things. The boys tell me that one thing they especially loved about him was his eccentric style of cooking, the way he would throw together the weirdest assortment of ingredients to make the most delicious meals. Steve was a keen footballer and played in local teams in Islington for many years. And the fact that he lived in a block of flats overlooking the Emirates Stadium only fanned the family football fever. Just a couple of weeks ago, he got tickets for the boys to watch Arsenal play Spurs, and I'm sorry to report, win 1-0. Steve was rightly very proud of his beautiful sons, just as they have every reason to be proud of their dad's accomplishments. Steve flung himself into relationships and projects, and he often made a go of them against all the odds. He became a skilled bricklayer and took the kind of pride in his work that old-styled artisans and craftsmen would have recognised. It was at this time that Robert Tressel's trenchant socialist novel, The Ragged Trouser Philanthropist, became one of his favourite books. Then he became a gardener, for a time was manager of a square in Paddington and also worked with a project for young offenders in Notting Hill. He shared his interest in gardening with Jean and used his skills to design and build a patio and pergola for her garden in Wivenhoe. Last year, he organised us into a workforce to lay a new path around the house. What he really enjoyed was a sense of a family working together, of being a team. Then, at the age of 30, he suddenly decided to go to college. This was partly due to the influence of his then-girlfriend, Sammy, who was just down from university and who opened up a new world for Steve. He overcame his fear of flying, and they travelled on holiday together to Spain, Greece, and the Adriatic. Their relationship might have been tempestuous, but they spent many happy times together. And so Steve signed up for a demanding 4-year course at Birkbeck. We were thrilled, but apprehensive, having dropped out of school at 15 without any qualifications, how could he possibly manage with no study skills? Why not do an access course first? But characteristically, he threw himself in at the deep end, into the challenging reading and assignments, and against all the odds, he succeeded. He discovered a passion for ideas, and worried at Marx and Freud as if a whole lot depended on understanding what they said, which indeed it does. He joined the British Library, the Marx Memorial Library. He studied late into the night. The essays he wrote caused him a lot of anxiety, but with some help and encouragement from Liz Haggard, Jean's cousin, the grades got better and better, and he ended by getting the equivalent of a 2-1. It was quite a remarkable achievement. Liz remembers him vividly enough. Vividly, even though she only met him a few times. So eager, so clever, so alive. He chose as one of his options a course on writing London. Steve loved London. He liked walking its streets, exploring off the beaten track, following his own line of desire, a solitary stroller, always on the lookout for the unexpected. He'd read Walter Benjamin for his course and agreed with him that to discover and truly to get to know a city, you must first learn how to get lost in it. He also liked to spend time on his own indoors. He was an accomplished chess player. At least he beat me with monotonous regularity. He liked reading and listening to music. He had a treasured collection of vinyl, mostly 60s indie band, but also jazz. He played the guitar. He taught himself and wrote his own songs, but he specialized in singing Kinks numbers. Ray Davies, with his bittersweet lyrics and wry appreciation of the absurdities of English suburbia, was his hero. And though he enjoyed the urban buzz of Camden and Bloomsbury, Steen also liked the quiet of the countryside, especially around Wivenhoe, where we spent much of our time in the summer. He'd been a cartoonist as a kid, and now, inspired by Dean's landscapes, he took up sketching and painting. In this as much else, he and Jean were kindred spirits. Steve was very generous and companionable. He may have sometimes been his own worst enemy, but he made and kept good friends, many of whom are here today. Friends like Graham, with whom he shared his interests and concerns over many years, and who has sent me this tribute. Steve was a wonderful person to know. He had so many interests and was always willing to try something new. He had such a wide range of knowledge and a very creative mind. Even with all his troubles, he still always managed to smile and laugh with all his heart. We didn't really do as many things together as we would have liked, but we always got lost in conversation, and I think our minds would meet in some really amusing places. He was always encouraging me to do something better with my life and step out of my comfort zone, and I will now do that just for him. Me and my family all loved him very much, and he was and always will be my best friend and most trusted. He was kind, caring, funny, friendly, honest, polite, intelligent, and many other things. Yet however convivial he was, Steve also felt himself to be a loner, an outsider. He didn't fit into the middle-class professional world we inhabited with its cozy social niceties, but neither was he entirely at home in the rough-and-tumble solidarities of laddish culture. Instead, he identified with rebels, with or without a cause, and was drawn to their company. He had no time for snobs, hypocrites, or poseurs. He spoke his heart and mind quite fearlessly. Boring, he wasn't. Steve was delighted to have an adoptive older brother, and Ned did his best to encourage and support him, though Steve sometimes felt a bit outdone, as younger brothers will. Having an academic and an artist for adoptive parents was not always easy either. When he was about 10, Steve once complained to me that whereas his friends' dads all did useful and exciting things, like drive lorries, build roads, or repair cars, I spent all my time at home playing with my computer. I seem to recall that not so long ago he said much the same thing to Ricky and Casey. Although we had our ups and downs, as every family does, Steve remained very much part of it. As soon as he was legally able, he changed his name from Cohen back to Thompson, but he never disadopted us. Jean stood by him through thick and thin. She never for an instant gave up on him. If love alone could cure alcoholism, Steve would be alive and well today. He in turn stood by Jean when I got ill, and his support did much to aid my recovery. But as I got better, he got worse. Unfortunately, he couldn't do for himself what he managed to do for others. He tried to assuage his inner demons through alcohol, but found, as so many have, that drink was the biggest demon of them all. He was, quite simply, addicted to its high. In his last message to Graham, texted after he discharged himself from the rehab centre where he spent the last 6 months, he wrote, "I'm flying high. I'm on my way to the carnival." The Notting Hill Carnival was very much Steve's kind of scene. He would have enjoyed its intoxicating conviviality, its music vibe. But what for others was just time out was for him a launch pad for what turned out to be his last fling. Steve was our Icarus. Now, some of you may know the story. And although it's drawn from ancient Greek mythology, I think it has a timeless relevance. The story is like this. Daedalus, a master craftsman, finds himself imprisoned in a labyrinth he has built to trap the Minotaur. In order to escape, he fashions two pairs of wings out of waxen feathers, one for himself and another for his son Icarus. Daedalus tries the wings first, and before taking off, warns his son not to fly too close to the sun, nor too close to the sea, but to follow his own middle course. But overcome by the elation of flying, Icarus ignores his father's instructions and soars ever higher in the sky until the sun melts the wax on the wings and he falls headlong into the sea and drowns. Now, we might think today that Icarus was the first prophetic victim of global warming, and perhaps in retrospect he was. But really, this is a cautionary tale about the impetuousness of youth and how the desire to make a big splash can end in disaster. Stephen was nothing if not impetuous. Whether he was waving or drowning, and it was sometimes difficult to tell the difference, he always made a splash. It was impossible to be indifferent to his presence, not to notice that he was there, which is one reason why his suddenly not being with us has come as such a shock. Michael Ayrton is a poet and artist who's made a special study of the Icarus myth, and in his book, The Testament of Daedalus, the grief-stricken father is bewildered by his son's uncompromising stance. This is from the poem he wrote. He cried defiance to the top of the sky. I could not hear him clearly. I do not know where he was all that time, but he was high, higher than wings could have carried a normal man. He made more of his wings than I can understand. What dark skill did he have to make of himself what he did? For though his fall outpaced his rise, it seemed to me a lifetime occupied his fall. We often felt bewildered by Stephen, especially as the alcoholism took over and made him at times a stranger to his family as well as his friends. Yet he continued to bounce back from what, for others, would have been devastating blows, and that was his dark skill. Sadly, in the last few weeks of his life, after he left the rehab centre, we lost touch with him. He didn't contact us. We didn't know where he was. We arrived at the hospital too late. We were not in time to be with him when he died. And since then, it has seemed as if we are not living in any other time than that occupied by his descent into the inferno. Every death, no matter how expected, is untimely. It unhinges our normal relation to time. The time of bereavement has been described as time lived without its flow. Close friends as well as family can feel the need to turn the clock back, to stay in a time where the person is still alive and there is no death. Steve would have none of that. He was always looking forward, making plans, living in anticipation of better things to come, even and especially when he feared the worst. Recently, for example, Dean's brother David helped him buy a van, and he was looking forward to running a small part-time business to pay his way through college. Although his cultural preferences were solidly rooted in what he saw as the golden age of the 1960s and 70s, which is something we shared with him, he resisted revisiting his own past, especially his early childhood, which is perhaps why he was never able to make use of psychotherapy. In that way, too, he is like the self-willed but fragile figure of Icarus, as portrayed in Michael Ayrton's poem, who is described as clenched, predatory on his rage, as he proudly proclaims his special destiny and foresees his end. In my flight and combat quest, in the day returning, here on my patch of brief-held height, by the late summer moon, I wait my death ahead. My proper ending, it is for this, close-hauled, alone, I count my minutes down. In the last few weeks of his life, Stephen was indeed close-hauled and alone, in free fall. His situation came to resemble all too closely that of Icarus, as described in the poem, when he says, I am blind who feared the shroud of dark, and I am black and ash who loved the light, who sought to love the sun and still defies the deep-sea darkness. What death is there for me who died in flight? Stee died in flight from his inner demons. He was one of the wild men who caught and sung the sun in flight and learned too late they grieved it on its way, celebrated in the Dylan Thomas poem. He was wrenched from us, halted in mid-stride because he never found a middle course. We tried to play Daedalus to his Icarus, but our words were carried away on the wind. We can only wonder what he might have become if he'd managed to face down the demon alcohol. In different circumstances, he might have been a real high flyer, an adept at extreme sports, perhaps, or an explorer, a travel writer, even a groundbreaker in one of the arts or sciences. Towards the end, Steve's striving to belong and be accepted, his search for a less destructive way of transcendence, found some tentative resolution in attending a local Catholic church near the rehab center. Here, perhaps, he got a brief sense of being at peace with the world in a way that eluded him in most of his life, a moment of communion with the love supreme that John Coltrane sings and plays about. For those he leaves behind, his sons, his friends, his family, there's little enough consolation. But the pain of bereavement also contains its own principle of hope, even especially for those who do not believe in an afterlife. Denise Riley, herself adopted, campaigner for adoptive children's rights, a fine poet and friend, recently lost her son and wrote a book about the experience. The book explores both the complicated feelings that bereavement can arouse in us, the anger and guilt as well as sadness, but also emphasizes that in sharing our grief, we ensure it does not turn into grievance. As we together mourn the loss of Steve, we can perhaps also take encouragement from his life to move beyond our personal comfort zones into a more adventurous space, to reverse the traditional saying, in the midst of death, we are in life. This is how Denise puts it, reflecting on the immediate aftermath of her son's passing on. In these first days, I see how rapidly the surface of the world, like a sheet of water that's briefly agitated, will close again silently and smoothly over a death. His, everyone's, mine. I see as if I am myself dead. This perception makes me curiously light-hearted. You share in the death of your loved one, in that you approach it so closely that you sense that a part of you too died instantly. At the same time, you feel that his or her spirit has leapt into you, so you are both partly dead and yet more alive. You are cut down, and yet you burn with life.
We're now going to listen to some of Steve's favourite music and watch some photographs.
You've done it all. You've broken every code. Paul the rebel to the floor. Nothing left, all gone and run away. Maybe you'll tarry for a while. It's just a test, a game for us to play. Win or lose, it's hard to smile.
An open mic, which means that if anybody would like to come and share their experiences of STEE, their memories, please come up and feel free to speak. I know it's difficult, and I don't know who would like to go first, if there's any volunteers who've prepared something. Fantastic. Monica.
I was one of Steve's godmothers. And I tried to keep in touch with Steve. Steve, or Stee as he now wanted to be known, although I once sternly told him that Stee was not appropriate to put on a CV. I tried to follow him throughout his path from childhood through the difficult teenage years to him becoming a fun and responsible, but still occasionally unpredictable father. Working in a succession of jobs and trades, giving them up to try something different, and then starting to catch up on his formal education and enrolling as a Birkbeck student. I want to share just a few memories of Steve as I experienced him with you. Sometimes it was easy to keep in touch with him because he was a loyal and loving soul who valued his blended family relationships and many of his friends. He knew that many people cared about him. Yet sometimes it was difficult to maintain contact with him because he had a strong, unpredictable streak in him. As a teenager, there was a number of situations where one was anxious about him and angry with him. Yet all one ended up saying to him at the end of one of those episodes was, "Thank goodness that you are all right." Steve had a strong sense of loyalty and fairness and justice, and he walked away from situations and even walked out of jobs when he felt that things had not been done right, that the principles that he valued weren't adhered to. He was also an independent and restless spirit who did not want to be pinned down. He played with different identities. Was he a working class kid from Huddersfield, or did he belong to the cosmopolitan academic and artistic world of his parents? Was his name Thompson or was it Cohen? Fairly recently, he said to me that he was considering changing his surname back again to Cohen, or perhaps using both names in a hyphenated fashion. And sadly and flippantly, I said, "Well, that will sound rather posh." I did not hear about the double name anymore subsequently, but he kept referring to Jean very much as his, "I've got to see my mum, and my mum feels this, and I need to make sure she's all right." Stephen was creative as a child, as we've seen on the film. He was able to draw stylish cards in a flash, just in time for birthdays or Christmas or whatever the occasion was. And later on, he developed the art of telling fabulous stories, and he told his own story in different ways to different people. And these stories, I'm sure, were somehow all real to him. Sadly, weekend binge drinking with friends developed over time into alcohol addiction. But he was determined to beat the alcoholism and went into rehab. And while he was going through this, he did not want to see many people until he had sorted himself out. He did sort himself out. But just at the point when he was ready to meet life's everyday challenges again and wanted to be with his family, particularly with the boys Ricky and Casey again, having left rehab, he had a fit and left us and this life for good. Throughout his all too short life, he was striving to get things right and to do the right things by other people, but seemed often unsure how to do it. I wish I could have been the sort of godmother they have in fairy tales, one that could cast a good spell to protect him from harm. But sadly, I couldn't do that, and none of us could.
Thank you, Monica. Anyone else like to say something very brief? We have an awful long time to go, but please, Liz.
I don't think I need to come up. I'm a teacher, right? And most of us remember maybe one teacher in our lives when they changed. But let me tell you, teachers remember pupils whom they thought, great, wasn't that lucky? And I've met Steve on and off at family parties, but at one particular party, he told me he was going to start at Berkeley. And I knew a bit about his educational, you know, he hadn't got the star A levels and so on. And I just felt I couldn't resist this potential there. So I said, well, if you would let me, I really love working with somebody who's got a lot of, you know, potential. I'd love to help you a little bit. So, you know, you say that the party and you go away. And I did get his email, and I did then say, here I am, how about it? And we met, both of us, I think, extremely nervously in a cafe on Houston Road. And I had three absolutely wonderful sessions with Steve. Just vivid, the word I keep thinking is vivid, vivid, vivid. He was so vivid in his personality, his enthusiasm, and his mind. And he was very pleased to be studying because he said, we're encasing the consciousness, they'll see that I'm learning, and learning is difficult, and it is difficult. So I just have these enormously good memories of this wonderful, vivid, intensely clever young man. And I'm grateful to him for that.
Thank you, Liz.
I'm the other godmother of Steve Lemon. Unfortunately, I was not able to see him as often as I would have liked to and tried to. But one of the things that came out was that Stephen was always, even when he was angry, he was very kind, very loving, very warm. I used to see him more during the Norfolk period rather than the Wolverhampton period, in which we shared a summer place. But my first memory of Stephen was when he came to our back garden shortly after he was adopted and just jumped on all the sheds in the garden and up the fence and with his usual kind of exuberance and great smile and laughter. And it was dangerous, but it was fun. And this was Stephen. And the last time I saw him was when he was a student and he came with Jean to my retirement conference. And he was so handsome. I thought I should bring him to a Hollywood film movie immediately. And the same smile, the same loving kindness and warmth. It's heartbreaking to be here today, but it's also heartwarming that so many people are here and have that memories of Stephen, and he will continue to be part of us.
I am Stephen's brother. I may not have been the best brother, but I will not forget the many ways that he has touched my life. I came here on Friday with my family to remember and celebrate Stephen. For me, it was important to see the reality of his passing. I was privileged enough to spend time with Natalie, the mother of Stephen's two wonderful boys, and their good friend Louise. I felt I had to say a few words. Steve touched the lives of everyone he knew. He was a man of many, many parts, who embraced life with energy and determination. He will not be forgotten and will live on within the hearts of everyone who knew him. We will all remember him in our own way. His intensity that burned as bright as any supernova, and his deep, heartfelt warmth and generosity of spirit. Whatever disappointment or letdown he faced, Steve kept going. His relentless determination. He did not stop trying or loving or giving. But through it all, he gave us something that will endure. He was human. Today, I thank Steve for reminding me of my humanity. I am humbled before him. He had the rare ability to accept people for who they were, not what they were. As a man in this world, he had deep respect for people. I was privileged to have known him. The small parts that I did know will affect me for the rest of my life. I'm grateful to Phil and Jean for bringing the boys, Rick and Casey, to Ireland to spend time with my family this summer. The boys are a credit to their mother, Natalie. And there's an open invitation. There will always be a place at my table for you and your family. The boys, one of Steve's lasting gifts to us. So handsome, such devilish good looks, such impish charm. If they have the generosity and humor, gentle ability to give and love of their father, they will be truly blessed. Steve, I will not and cannot forget. In my heart, where the truth resides, I will hold you through always.
Thank
I do. Would anyone else like to say a little word? Any of Steve's friends? Yes? Graham.
I don't really know. I can't think of a story, but sorry, they're not coming to me. But what I can say is I loved him like a brother. I did love him and didn't understand the problem that he had. And I'm sorry about that. The only thing that I can remember is the last thing that he did for me. And that was when I'd left him at my flat after he'd stayed overnight. That night he was on about me always leaving my curtains closed. I've got a bad habit for keeping my curtains closed. And when I went back there the next day after he'd gone, he'd spring clean for me and left the curtains wide open, and the sun was just beaming through, and that's the last thing he did for me. So, yeah.
I haven't written anything down, but I'm Danny, one of Steve's friends. Steve was just always, to me, like someone who, it's been said before, but he was a people person. He liked people. He wasn't the most sociable of people, but you know, when you saw him, he was always asking about you and how you were, and not only you, but he'd also ask about your family or your friends or your girlfriend, and he was always just very courteous like that. And I mean, we had a lot of passions that we shared. We both loved music, and we'd kind of get lost in conversation talking about music and kind of gigs we've been to see. And the first concert I ever bought tickets for, I called Steve up straight away and I said, I've got, you know, a couple of tickets for a concert. Would you like to come? And he was there. And it was probably one of the best nights of my life. And we kind of shared that together. So, but I think the last time I saw Steve was about maybe 18 months ago, a long time ago. But it was very vivid in my mind, kind of how he was such an engaging person. When you had a conversation with him, he spoke to you, you know, and he never looked at his phone. He was always, you know, he was always interested in what you had to say. And I think the thing what struck me is when he talked about his horticultural studies was, you know, he was a person of nature. Like, he loved, you know, he loved gardening and being out in the countryside, and same as, you know, what I do. And the sort of the values that he had were, you know, they were top class. And you know, I never once saw him got angry or anything. He was never an aggressive person to anyone. And so, yeah, I just, you know, I hope he rest in peace.
I just want to tell people about the book that it would be lovely if you haven't spoken and you'd like to just say a few of the memories of Steve. Just something, just one sentence. Unfortunately, we're running a little bit late, so rather than fill it in now, I'm going to take it back to Lauderdale House, where I hope you all come, have some impressions, and you'll have time to maybe do something. So we have time for one more short contribution. Someone would like to speak? Yeah.
A poem from Natalie to Steve. God saw you getting tired, and cruel was not to be. So he put his arms around you and whispered, "Come to me." With tearful eyes we watched you and saw you pass away. Although we loved you dearly, we could not make you stay. A golden heart stopped beating, hard working hands at rest. God broke our hearts to prove to us he only takes the best.
Okay, so we're now going to have the last piece of music, which is You'll Never Walk Alone. and we will all make our way towards the problem. No, I have to get them out of here. There is one to say. The washing. A leg of music.
It's called the Gaelic farewell. It's together with part of Stephen's family. May the road rise to meet you. May the wind be always at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face. May the rain fall softly upon your fields until we meet again. And may God hold you in the hollow of his hand.
When you walk through a storm, hold your head up high, and don't be afraid of the dark. At the end of a storm, there's a golden sky and the sweet silver song of love. Walk on through the oh.